Okay, welcome to ITE 1, Class 2, Module 1. And before I start, does anyone have any questions related to course stuff?
Now's your time. If you've got any questions, you know, where do I find the text notes, my curriculum, mate, my cat, yeah, all those sorts of questions.
That'd be pretty good.
I'd like to see that.
I'm pretty sure I know where to find everything.
Scavenger assignment is due before you submit any other worksheet. End of today, be good. We did put it out earlier in the week. We want it to be the first assignment that people finish off.
Please, the reward for your scavenger hunt is getting your worksheets. Great. But a lot of people have got... Ah, I know. I don't know why this is.
A lot of people are getting it in. We've got a lot of scavenger hunts. We're quite happy with the scavenger hunts. Now... Hang on. Depends on you. It honestly depends on how quickly you work. I would estimate 2 to 3 hours a week per subject that you're doing out of lecture, but it really depends on how efficiently you use a computer. I know people that would do all of the work in half an hour, and then they would be done, but I also know other people who would take 3 or 4 hours to actually research all the stuff up. So it really is student dependent, but I'd say maybe 2 to 3 hours extra work a week per course if you work along at a fair click. The worksheets are due within a month of the lecture being presented. That's for your benefit, not for ours, because we find that if you do the worksheets just after you've done the modules, you'll remember the stuff in the modules, and that makes the worksheets easier. Sorry, you finished sensitivity?
I think I am. I'm just trying to find the Ventrilo window because it's gone.
Has it dropped into the task tray?
Okay. I've never seen it do that before.
Okay. No, me neither. That's just different. So hopefully I don't need it, because it's gone, guys. All right. Yeah, get the worksheets in as soon as you can, because then we'll be able to grade them. Oh, it's at like 30 now.
We usually have these AutoVox problems in the first lecture because we need to tune up for a particular headset. Instructors tend to go on AutoVox so that we can read braille displays and stuff without having to hold the key down. Just bear with us for a moment. But welcome everybody to ITE 1 Class 2. I'm just filling while Grace is messing around. And we look forward to taking you through the intricacies of being a Level 1 support technician and those sorts of things. This course is basically going to teach you the troubleshooting process. It's going to teach you how to do tech support. Grace has just closed out of Ventrilo. She'll be right back. It will also teach you how to choose hardware components and how to pick parts for your computer. And it will also teach you the rudiments of disassembling and reassembling computers. Now, has everybody accessed the ITE1 curriculum? This should make you all happy and fuzzy and warm inside because it's in text files that can go onto any of your little accessibility devices. Has anybody not accessed the ITE1 curriculum yet? And if you haven't, soon would be a good time to get into those lecture notes, because the notes that you will find on the website are the notes that we are lecturing from. Has anybody read the chapter? Has anybody pre-read the chapter?
Yes.
Hurrah! Okay.
Fair enough.
Good stuff.
All right, hopefully this will work better, and I'm probably much louder than I was, too.
I've just got to move Alan in.
Awesome. All right. We were at like 50% on the microphone settings, so that could have been half my problem.
I said that yesterday.
So you did. All right, guys. If nobody has any questions, I've got a question for you. What is IT?
Information technology.
Very good. That's half a mark. You've managed to expand the acronym.
What does it mean? What is it? What does IT involve?
I think it is. It basically you're learning about the hardware and software and how to help other people with it. Is that all of the bits of it?
Not quite, actually. The actual meaning for the term information technology is the technology that is used for the collation and distribution of information. So we could say that printers are part of information technology. We could say that photocopiers are part of information technology. Generally, information technology refers to computers, as in the ones that we're used to, but those computers are responsible for processing data and turning it into information. Data being the raw material and information being the finished product. So information technology is the technology that is used for the manipulation of information.
And if you're asked in the text, it is a term that encompasses the relationship between hardware, software, networks, and technical assistance provided to users. It is the design, development, and implementation, support, and management of computer hardware software applications. So now that we've got that covered, we'll talk about what this course actually covers. This course covers both desktop and laptop computers and their peripherals. So that means, yes, we'll be talking about printers and scanners, external CD burners, all sorts of peripherals that go with the computers, and how to support them as well. We will also touch on PDAs and mobile phones. We'll do some troubleshooting. We'll learn how to pick out parts to buy for a computer and to upgrade a computer if you want to build or upgrade your computer. We will talk about how to help out customers. We'll talk a little bit about security, and we'll talk a little bit about networking. Does anyone have any questions about what the course covers or what is involved in the course?
I have a comment. We will be covering most of this from a sighted perspective with blind additions bolted on. This means that if we do need to do a huge section on operating system installation, for example, under 10s or whatever, this will not be covered in the regular lectures. We will have to do that on a different time slot, because by the time we get through the material that is involved in the course, we don't have a lot of time for doing messing around with unattended installations. We have 13 regular modules to get through, but we will certainly do unattended installations and stuff if people show an interest, possibly on a Thursday night your time, and if you can't attend that, there will certainly be recordings available.
In addition to that point, if you guys want to know what something looks like, if you guys need something described, I took that Windows class I was telling you about. So sometimes I take that people know what something looks like for granted. Please stop me, and we will try to describe things for you and give you a good idea of how things look.
Yeah, just a reiteration. That no question is a stupid question. If there is a question that you want to ask, post it to the instructors, KV instructors, or if you want your fellow font of knowledge to help you, the mailing lists are an excellent resource. And we are glad to see that people have been using them. However, questions such as, what time is my class, is probably best sent to the instructors.
And also, the other thing you want to send to your instructors is exam activation requests. And for you guys who have not taken the skills exam, it's up for another week. And I'd really like to make this the last week that that's activated, because once you start doing worksheets, your skills assessment really doesn't count, because you've already started learning and working on these lectures. All right. Any questions on any of that? All right, sounds good. Now we'll talk about certifications. Earning an industry standard certification will give you increase your opportunities in IT. This course is designed to help you prepare for the A+ certification and the EUCIP, which is a European certification that most of you will not actually be studying for because you're not in Europe. So we're going to mainly focus this today on the A+. Certification that you'll be most likely to study for. Both of these are entry certifications. You're welcome to study for more specialized certifications such as NET Plus or the CCNA. Just out of curiosity, does anybody know who develops and designs the CCNA?
Yes, go for it.
Is that Cisco itself?
It actually is Cisco itself. So if you're in Discovery and doing Discovery 1 through 4, you may be sitting the CCNA. NET Plus is designed by CompTIA, who are the same people that do the A+ certification. A+ certification shows that you are a qualified hardware and software technician. It's known as one of the best ways to enter the IT field and gain a good career because it gets your foot in the door. Go ahead. Now somebody mic'd up.
No, I don't think so. Okay, well, let's continue on anyway.
Never mind. It's the best way to get a good career because you get a foot in the door with the employers because they know that you know something and that you have at least a base knowledge of your hardware and software, and they don't have to start you from scratch. It can also be used as university credits if you're going into a computer science major or information technology, information sciences, computer forensics type of thing. You can get some credit for having an A-plus certification in some universities. To get the A-plus certification, you have to take two exams. The first one is the A-plus essentials exam, which covers the basics of computer building, repairing, and maintaining PCs, and you also get some of your soft skills stuff thrown in there. Then you have to take one of the three specialty exams. These are IT technician, which means that you're either a corporate or mobile environment. You can also take the remote technician exam, which means that you will be as a help desk technician in a call center, or you can take the depot technician exam and be someone like someone who works for Geek Squad and works mostly in a computer lab and has minimal customer interaction. Now, the book doesn't tell you this, but the IT technician is probably the most challenging exam, and the depot technician probably the least challenging specialty exam. I took a course on A-plus exam prep, and that's what we learned. So it depends on how ambitious you are and what you want to do. But any three of those exams will get you A-plus certified. Any questions on the A-plus?
Is anybody finding Grace a bit p-y? Just shift
a
that
bit,
mic.
But also sometimes you cut out, though, so it's going to be hard to balance, I think.
No, it's not like the CCNA. You are certified for life with the A+. So once you've done it, you're...
Yeah, the A+ doesn't tend to expire like the CCNA does. However, it's certainly not as swisho a certification as the Cisco one. It's a general technician certification. So you might find that once you get the A+, you would want to go on and specialize in a particular field after you've got the A+. Am I still talking because you're mixer tinkering? Okay. However, one of the things that this... another thing that this course also... you can take the A-plus test after you have done ITE1 and CS110 or one of the other topics, because there is actually other information covered in the A-plus. The A-plus tests are taken...
There we go. Is that better?
Now you have to drop your sensitivity back down.
Okay.
And it's picking me up as well. So probably down a little bit.
Yeah.
Oh, just a bit. Hold on.
It's not an internal mic. It's just the noise floor.
Very, very loud.
It's interesting that you say the IT technician is harder and the depot exam is easier, because my mind thinks completely backwards on that one. My mind thinks.
But with the depot technician, you are only
down
doing
a bit.
Down. Okay.
It's not distorting, it's the noise floor.
What volume are you at, Chris?
I'm at 100.
Go down, it's about 80. Or you could turn your boost off.
That's what I'm going to do. Is that better?
Noise floor has dropped down.
Or is this better?
No, that's good.
Oh, much better. There you go.
The noise floor is the level of noise that is present in a signal. You're probably going to have to drop your sensitivity a bit because I'm opening your microphone.
Okay.
Underneath the actual signal itself, so if you look at the signal-to-noise ratio, that is the level of signal-to-noise, the noise being the unwanted information in the transmission. One of the things that you'll often notice, and it looks like, is that when you turn on a microphone boost, it boosts everything by 20 dB, including the background noise, as you've just discovered. But this is a course on computing, not audio engineering. And we have a question.
Yeah, it's JJ. When you get your A+ certification, does it say A+ and the type you get, or do you just say that you're A+ certified?
It does say what type you get. So the IT is harder because you're learning for both a mobile environment and a corporate environment. You're not just learning bench tech. So you've got to do the soft skills and people support stuff as well as the computer support stuff.
Okay. Your mic is still loud, by the way.
You're quiet, JJ.
Okay. But your mic is loud too.
Yeah, that's right. But on this server, we're going to peg you just below the top of the red. Because when we do a normalization, I'd really rather not smash all the dynamics out of this if I could help it. Because it makes it a very radio-like listening experience.
Just shift it up a little bit, Chris.
Up? It's far away from me.
Okay, then you need to take another 10% off your battery.
Okay. Just see if anyone else has any questions on A+.
Yeah, anybody else have any questions on A+, apart from that? If not, then we'll go on to the next point while Grace tidies this up. And in future, we will try and do our microphone sorting out before lecture. We apologise in advance, but... Grace was tidying up her notes.
It worked fine yesterday, so figured it'd be okay today.
It's a different headset though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, when you change the headset, you've got to recalibrate it.
There we go, that should be a little bit better.
You cannot get a certificate if you get IT 1 and Discovery 1. Not enough juice to do any of the exams. You need Discovery 1 and 2 for CCENT. And you need... I'm still opening that microphone, unfortunately, but not a lot we can do about that. You need CCNA 1 and 2 for CCENT, and you need ITE 1 and the CS110 for A+ certification.
How is the A+ certification actually taken? How do you... Actually, is it just all online? Do you have to sit with someone...
You have to actually go into a Pearson VUE testing center, and they're all over the United States. There's one in every major city, at least one in every major city, and some technical colleges are Pearson VUE learning centers. You actually go in, and you don't get anything except the computer they provide you, and you do get scratch paper, which isn't going to help you very much. You have to ask them for a reader. But if you're going to take the A+ certification, we talk to them about the fact that you're coming and try to work with you on your accommodations.
Also, you are provided a reader. I'll just move right over near this wall. You are provided a reader. I'm still keying that, unfortunately. And nothing else. So your reader can scribble stuff on the scratch paper for you, but essentially the stuff is generally done in your head. If you need other modifications, such as a brailler or similar, you can certainly do that.
And you also get extra time on the test.
Does the computer have a screen reader on it?
Costs are up on cisco.netacad.net. Look it up there. Essentially, you get a half-price voucher. I believe the current price is $250 for the half-price, $500 for the full price.
Does the computer have a screen reader on it?
No.
Or rather, can you put one on?
Nope.
So what is the computer for, then, if you're not able to pretty much not put a screen reader or anything on it?
The test is actually done by you telling the reader the answers. And we are working towards getting screen readers on computers, but once we put screen readers on computers, we then need to come up with an audit process to make sure that you don't load stuff on that cheats. We wouldn't accuse anybody of doing that, but it can happen, and they're very strict about what goes on the computer.
I don't even think the computer may not even be a Windows computer. It might be their own kind of testing proprietary computer. I'm not sure. But I've heard somebody had said that to me once.
So the reader drives the computer for you, is that what you're saying?
Yep, it's a reader and a scribe. And most of the time in America, it's provided by Pearson View, so you don't know who you're going to get.
Fun.
Oh yeah, especially for diagram descriptions. So that's why it's very important to really know what things look like and understand how people might describe a diagram to you. And that's why we do the diagram descriptions in this course.
I have heard stories where they actually get the janitor or the cleaner to do the diagram descriptions for you so that they won't know anything about ITE.
Ew!
Yeah, wow. I was in a hardware class in school, and my instructor, you guys are very spoiled because you guys get these nice diagram descriptions. My instructor was doing diagram descriptions for me, and he tried to be as vague as possible so that I would get the experience of that janitor or cleaner doing it for me. It was good.
So does that teach you the right questions to ask?
Alright,
I'm not using your computer. Okay. I'll give you the headset.
Cool. So, I'm plugged in.
Oh, gotcha.
Bumpy bump.
I will tune this one up.
Need a technical difficulty screen.
How long you have for which? Okay, you get a normal student will get 90 minutes, I believe it is, and the standard in America is time and a half, so you would get an additional 45 minutes, I believe.
I believe it's double time if you're visually impaired, but if you're low vision, I think it hits like time and a half.
That actually depends. I'm going to tune this up in a second, guys. That actually depends on the testing centre and what they've given you. There is no standard. We're still working towards those standards. And it depends what you can negotiate with Pearson View.
They usually go by the college standards, which I think he's right. Something like that. Time and half, double time. Sometimes you might even get unlimited time, but probably not.
I assume you're allowed to ask questions of your reader when, you know, he's doing diagram descriptions, like, does it contain this or what?
Absolutely.
What the screen saying?
You are allowed to do that. And there's somebody in the room watching you take the test, so that's all good as well. And your reader can answer any questions about the diagram that you have. So yes, there's that.
Can you, like, ask for a different one if he's just not doing a good job of answering your questions?
You can't do that, I don't believe. Okay, you can... Okay, hold on, Rosie, I'll get to you in a second. If you have a really bad reader, after the exam, you can lodge a complaint, and you can probably get to resit the exam. But it's not like, oh, I don't like this reader. I want a new reader. It probably won't. They probably won't. That probably won't happen.
You have to pay for it again, though, right?
It depends. Hopefully not, if you can prove a good enough point. What now? Rosie, you had a question?
Yes, I did. You said something, or Carrie said something about NC110. What is that?
It's still being written. It's going to be Linuxy, scripty stuff.
So that is a course that you guys offer? Is that it?
It's going to be a course, if we have funding next year, that we will be offering.
It'll be a course we'll be offering in July if we have funding, Grace. The course will be running in July.
Okay, next semester. That's what I meant.
Okay,
would it make sense to take that after ITE1 before you take ITE2, then?
That is going to be the replacement to ITE2.
Oh, okay. All right, thanks.
ITE2 has been discontinued, so we don't run ITE2 anymore.
Is there a particular reason for that?
HP.
It was unbelievably outdated, and HP pulled the funding on it.
So even Cisco took it, not just you guys?
It's gone. Cisco decided. The Cisco Learning Institute is not as rich as the corporate division of Cisco. So the Learning Institute runs on a shoestring budget like we do. And basically it turned out that they lost the... HP pulled the funding, so Cisco decided they couldn't be bothered continuing IT2. They didn't want to spend the resources to update it.
Are there any more questions about the A-plus certification? If you want to learn about the European certification, refer to your notes, because it's not something that you guys will be studying for, so I figured that we would just let you guys check out the notes on that.
Yeah, we know. But would you like us to sort this out inside your lecture time, or would you like us to actually get on with the notes? It's your choice. Seriously, we will sit down and be audiophiles when we've got the time to do so, and we will tidy up the audio, we promise. You could knock another 10% off if you feel inclined, Grace, but it's up to you. Otherwise, we'll sort it outside a lecture. We'd rather get through the material today, and then we will tune up the audio setup and stuff on the netbook with the stuff. The netbook is only a temporary fixture. She will be generally broadcasting from her workstation, which will need recalibration again.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of switching computers, so that's the problem with it. Once I have my regular computer, I'll be able to make it go right.
It's really not that bad. I'd say you just get on with it.
There you go. I just took off about another 33% on that mic boost, so that should help you out.
Fantastic.
Good. I'm really sorry about that, but I'm just using this little netbook at the moment while I transfer over my stuff to this other computer.
We will sit down with the SoundForge VU meters and the Braille display in pure blind geek fashion and watch the dB levels and tidy it all up, but just not right now.
I hope that this is okay. If it's not...
It's fine now.
Well.
Yeah, it's excellent. More than okay. It's excellent.
Perfect. Really sorry about that, you guys, again. Okay, now that we've gotten that done, no other questions about the A+, are there? It's good. It's not as bad as it sounds. And once... Oh, beautiful. Okay, so, yeah, it's really not that bad of a test. So... you just have to make sure that you get the accommodations you need, and they know what accommodations you're actually allowed to have, and don't go in and ask for stuff that really you shouldn't be asking for. Okay, let's talk about the differences between hardware and software. Can anyone tell me what they think hardware is? Okay, go ahead.
You're going ahead, I think, Drew. Or not.
Actually, I think it was Jerry.
It was Gary.
Gary, okay. You going ahead, are you, Gary? Ah, well, when you find it, let us know. yeah, it's scary, guys. So if you've got a custom dictionary, get in and do that. And do Mikhail while you're at it, because Jaws just says it wrong.
Okay. Well, since his hotkey has vanished on him in a puff of smoke,
Yeah, you can find your hotkey in setup. Hardware has immutable existence. I've got a hammer that says otherwise, but I know what you're saying. No, but seriously, you are correct. Hardware is the actual solid things that you can put your hands on and pick up and throw at the wall when it doesn't work.
Absolutely. Hardware's the physical. Hardware's the case. The motherboard. The CPU. The RAM. Even the CD that your software is on. Software is the stuff that makes your computer tick. It is responsible for identifying, retrieving, and processing information. As we know, and I just have to say this, all computers need operating systems. But I think we all know that. So, does anyone have any questions about the differences between hardware and software? No question's a stupid question. Well, just making sure. You never know. All right. So,
middleware is programs that are written by... I'm trying to think of the exact definition. Middleware is programs like databases and spreadsheets and stuff that are written to do a job between different things. I'm just trying to think of an example of middleware. We don't cover it, but Wikipedia it up. It's not in the tests or anything. I'd need to get an exact definition for you, but perhaps going into Google and putting define colon middleware will scare one up for you.
We do talk about firmware, which is what I'd probably say, semi-permanent software that is built into hardware, such as a BIOS. Oh, there you go.
That's a good definition. I like that.
Because, let's say, for a phone or a computer, the firmware is always there, unless it gets... corrupted, and that's quite hard to do, or you flash it and rewrite it. It's not like a program. You don't usually uninstall and reinstall it. It's always there, and you need to really make a strong effort to upgrade or do something to it.
I've got a definition for middleware here.
Okay.
This middleware is software or software components that connects software packages and hardware. In other words, the software that makes computers and stuff do useful work over a network or makes multiple applications communicate together. So there you are. And that's on Wikipedia under middleware.
All right. We don't have Mr. Wikipedia in our class anymore, so we'll just have to do it ourselves.
Huh? So just one quick point here. There were actually a whole set of computer viruses before motherboard manufacturers started setting write protection on their flash that would actually go and wipe your flash BIOS for you.
Beautiful.
Ouch.
And then there's another,
that's right.
Then there was another couple of nasties that could trash the contents of your CMOS and stuff, so you'd have to go and reset it all up again.
Okay, Rosie, go ahead.
Who is Mr. Wikipedia?
Graham Pierce. He was one of our ex-students, 2007. Spends his life editing Wikipedia articles. In fact, he is a Wikipedia admin. And he was studying with us in 2007.
Dear God.
Interesting.
Yeah. Scary. All right. It is time to talk about components of a computer. We're basically going to go and talk about the case and the power board, or motherboard and power supply and CPU today, because we're only going to get through about half of this chapter because I figured we'd probably have a slow start. And I don't want to fry your brains on the first week. That would be bad. So,
just a point. We politically correct problem system boards now. even though the notes say mother, apparently we are not meant to have a gender bias, and they are called system boards. Joy, joy.
When was that?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
When did they say that?
Oh, a couple of years ago we were told that we were supposed to call them system boards.
They called them motherboards on the manufacturer website.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, yeah, I think really. That's one political correctness thing that never took hold, so...
And the stream
just in case you say system board.
Yeah, the stream thinks it's a motherboard. There's moths in it.
Oh, that's special.
That made me laugh so hard today.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
Okay, well, that's okay. Our motherboard, we'll talk about the motherboards in a little bit. But first we're going to talk about a case.
We'll call them mothboards. Confuse everyone.
The case provides protection, cooling, and support for internal parts of the computer. What do you think the case provides protection from?
Dust, debris, you name it.
Bugs.
Yes, that's some of the protection the case provides.
Yeah, but there are other things besides physical stuff that can get into the... Yeah. There are other things that can get into
the case.
Yes, the user. That aren't physical, exactly physical things. There are other things that the case protects from.
Can anybody tell me why is a computer made of metal?
Heat exposure?
No.
Grounding.
Absolutely. Ding, 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 ding. Lollipops.
What was that for?
Static electricity.
No. No, that wasn't the answer I wanted either.
It's for grounding. It's to keep static electricity from happening, isn't it?
That's part of it, the most important reason for a computer case being made of metal, and you are correct, the computer case is grounded, but the metal case acts as a Faraday cage and prevents electromagnetic interference from spilling into the surrounding environment so that your TV doesn't go bung when you turn the computer on.
Oh, okay.
So, it also protects the rest of the world from your computer.
I don't know whether anybody's ever read a computer manual, but on page 1 it says, this component is designed to comply with Class A of the FCC emissions for electromagnetic interference, which guarantees that in normal operation a computer should not cause interference with any other devices in your house, or should be able to handle any interference generated by other devices in the house. And then it goes on to tell you about how they say that interference might actually occur, and you should probably get a technician or somebody to check out the fact that there's interference, and you can try reorienting your antennas and all that sort of good stuff. But the Class A is the interference levels for a factory, and Class B are the interference levels for a home or residential installation, I should say. That depends on who you are.
I've seen in a lab environment, I've seen a computer without a case, and I'm like, oh, wow. So in that kind of environment, it's just a nuisance. If you're a home user, it's probably pretty dangerous.
B is less, because it's got to be tighter interference restrictions for a home environment.
If you read a lot of manuals, you'll see that over and over again.
You will. One of the things to keep in mind about a computer without a case, and yes, there are people who do have all of the computers scattered out on the bench, but the problem with that is that stuff can drop into the fans, stuff can drop onto the system boards, and if you spill some liquid onto the system board without the case in the way, you're probably going to short the thing and you'll let the smoke out. So that's certainly something we'd like to avoid.
Really, for us, it's not the best of all ideas to have a computer without a case. A case is a really good thing, and while it might be a little harder to work in, it does provide us some protection and keeps our computer components from being knocked around, because one good blindy swipe and, well, that computer's at least got something disconnected from it, eh? Go ahead.
How much, let's see if it's going to work, yes. How much metal does it need to be in the case to protect from the electromagnetic interference? Because my computer has a fair amount of plastic in it now, and I've seen several
that have, you know, polymer and other various things that are not metal in any way.
In theory, the metal should surround a majority of the components, and in fact plastic cases are really bad for interference. They look cool and you can see through them, but you can find that there will be more RF leakage and stuff from the cases, but as the components have gotten tighter and tighter on the RF emissions, the case designers have got looser and looser on how much shielding they're actually going to provide.
There are, I believe, actually all plastic cases, I think I saw one of those, and I was like, that is cheap.
Most of it's metal. Like, the side panels are metal, and the back is metal, and I think the front is metal as well. It's mostly the top that's plastic, and there's, like, a plastic window on one of the side panels.
Then you're probably just fine.
Yes, there is.
Oh, yeah. That's why he unplugged the power cord.
No. Inside the power supply, there is 240 volts on the active side of the power supply. On the other side of the power supply, sorry, has that loose problem resolved itself, or is it still dicey?
Occasionally, you'll say a word and it'll drop you down for a tiny second, and then you'll come back up. I don't know how to really describe it, but...
It's like the battery's going out on a portable mic or something.
It's a crummy headset.
It's like this microphone has been abused so much.
Look, Grace has got my good set of headphones, my $215 set of headphones, because she's the one who's primarily doing the lecturing, so we'll see how we go. What the hell was I on about?
No.
No, I wasn't talking about mercury. I'm talking about 240 volts being on the active side of the power supply where the wall plugs in, or 110 volts if you're in the US. The power supply is in a metal box. Unless you are me, or Will Taylor, or somebody who knows what you are doing, do not open the metal box that contains the power supply. There are capacitors that can bite you and throw you across the room, and they will literally throw you across the room, and you'll be crumpled up against a wall feeling not very happy. Okay? So don't open the power supply unless you know what you're doing.
No, don't open the power supply ever, ever, ever. That's the notes say that. Because if you open up the power supply, and you've got to get screws, and you've got to actually really mean to do this, you guys, so it's not something that you're just accidentally going to do. Don't open it.
The little metal box that's got all the wires coming out of it, don't open the little metal box. They do screw that on and put a warranty void if removed sticker over one of the screws for a reason. Unless you're somebody who's quite experienced, like Mr. Taylor and I sometimes take power supplies apart, remove fans, oil them with sewing machine oil, remove the excess oil with blue tack, and then put the power supply back together. We know what we're doing. We've had 10, 15 years experience. But generally speaking, you should not be opening power supplies. They are dangerous beasts.
And they both have probably flown across the room a few times, too. So, yeah.
Yes, I've had the power supply go, and all the smoke pours out of it. And I press the button once, and bang! I've got a little bit of light perception. There was a really bright flash, and then nothing, and a lot of smoke, and a lot of... And then we disconnected it and got a new power supply. But it's fairly rare. Power supplies don't blow up too often. And when they do, usually there's just one big flash and then that's the end of it. They're pretty safe things to blow up. My brothers did catch fire once, though. My brother's girlfriend came and woke him up and said, Dan, fire in your computer. And he's like, yeah, whatever. And she's like, no, Dan, there really is a fire in the computer. And he came out and there really was a fire in his computer.
Wow.
It was a gigabyte system board, what can I say?
Don't you usually have some form of warning? Like, are you ever surprised when the power supply explodes?
Oh, yeah. Sometimes...
would you always be surprised when a power supply explodes? That's not what you expect to happen.
Yeah, it turns off...
All I get knows to beep first.
No.
It doesn't come up your screen and say, power supply exploding in 5 seconds. Please move away from computer.
Self-destruct button built into the power supply. No, but, like, isn't it already in some way broken, like you're working on it, or does it just humming along one day, and you come in from walking the dog, and
pretty much. I was actually sitting working on a server, and I was just customizing the firewall rules on my firewall, and I was just about to commit the changes, and all of a sudden, and that was the end of the firewall.
Nice.
And everything else.
Wow.
There's supposed to be a fuse, but the fuse only protects power supply from drawing too much current. It doesn't stop, say, the FETs from blowing up or the capacitors bulging and busting. And one of the things you tend to find is sometimes the electrolytic capacitors get old and some of the dielectric dries out and they go bang.
Now we're going to have students with... It depends if your power supply is going to be enough for your needs. When you're actually customizing a computer and building it, you want to get a power supply that has more wattage than you actually need at that time so that you can upgrade and put more components in. But if you're computer case already came with a 500 watt power supply, you're probably good.
Now I get to make stupid noises. This is my favorite bit of this lecture one. Has anybody ever had a computer that suddenly started going then eventually it gets quieter and goes well, that means your fan's got dust in it. And sometimes your power supply fan can do that, and you can replace the fans, or you can replace the power supply. But that's essentially the noise that they make.
I had my
unless you know what you're doing.
I got an external terabyte drive, which basically two 500 gig drives stacked on top of each other, and I stopped using it because it was making a scary noise. And then like a year later, I opened up the case, and it turned out it was the fan that was making that noise. So I just took the drives out, and now they're internal drives, and that's where my terabyte is from now.
Unless you know what you're doing, it's probably going to be a replace the power supply job, because you don't want to try and take those fans out of the power supply.
Yeah, it can. A lot of the times you can get dust on the floor, or you can just live in Perth and too close to Midland Brick. So sometimes environmental considerations, such as how much dust is in the air, how much pollen is in the air, or if you smoke. And in fact, I have a technician friend who charges people the smoker's tax. He actually adds $60 onto the computer repair price if you're a smoker, because he's sick and tired of cleaning all the crap out of the computer.
And they get gunky and nasty and absolutely gross if you smoke. All that tar and stuff goes and lands in your vents and sits in your computer until somebody goes and cleans it out.
About the weirdest sound I've had is I had my Mac Mini literally tweeting like a bird rhythmically, and I guess the fan needed replaced, and it took me a while to convince the Apple Store that that was the problem.
Oh, Grace's Braille Sense last night.
My Braille Sense is making a crazy noise. It needed to be charged. It's going
which is Braille Sense for I need my battery charged, apparently.
I guess so. It's just going nuts.
Wow, scary.
I had an UPS explode one night. That was fun. The circuitry in the UPS just went... Now there's sparks pouring out of it. And my wife at the time was brave enough to go and run over and rip the power cord out of it. But it was going pop, bang, thud. It was great. Anyway, yeah, that's always good.
I blew up a handy cassette recorder battery once.
Wow.
One or two?
Okay. One. It was a two.
Well, two's cheaply made.
What a surprise.
Yeah, I once made my speaker system sound like it was a washing machine or drill or some horrible, terrible noise. And still, to this day, don't know what the freaking problem was.
All right.
Now is the computer off.
Oh, they do too. Now that we've done our explosion talk, we should probably move on, or we won't finish the half a lecture that I had for today.
Anybody who wants to hear more explosions, get a copy of Best of the Bangs off blindcooltech.com. Yeah, they did.
I have a question about power supplies, actually.
Go ahead.
I was wondering what 80 plus certified is exactly. I imagine it's some sort of environmental thing.
I've never heard of it.
I've heard of Energy Star.
Yeah, Energy Star is a... Energy Star, yeah, if something's Energy Star, that means... I have no idea. If something's Energy Star, that means when it's in standby, it's going to pull less than 30 watts of power. And that it has a mode where it will go into standby.
No. In fact, the Energy Star ratings have a different number of stars that actually refer to how much power is drawn by the device, and less than 30 watts is not on every Energy Star rating. For example, there's no washing machine that pulls less than 30 watts. Energy Star is a badly designed standard that's supposed to show you which things are power efficient and which things are not. But none of the manufacturers ever managed to agree on it, and they just made up their own standards. And basically, there are things that do pull less than 30 watts in standby, but what you also find is that if you go and pull out a watt meter and measure it, it's not actually the case. So that's the theory, but the practice is that Energy Star is not really that well adhered to, and most people don't tend to take the actual ratings for Energy Star that seriously.
Oh, well, that's what the guy at Sears said about the air conditioner. Said it was something about less than 30 watts in standby. So.
But that depends on the appliance. I mean, a fridge, for example, has different wattage requirements than a computer, and it differs depending on what device you're looking at. Yes, Sean?
Actually, Drew, I think the 80 plus is supposed to be it's 80% efficient. I think I remember reading that somewhere, but I don't remember where.
Yeah,
are you
that'd be
the
right.
The number 80?
Okay.
The number 80?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, 80 plus.
Yeah, that would be right, I'd say. There are other standards like UVL or whatever that is various safety considerations and stuff as to how the power supply is constructed. I can tell you that if you buy a 500-watt power supply for $20, it's probably a pretty dicey circuit board in... Oh, they do. Good deal for you.
Over here we get extra Asian market power supplies over here.
I would literally be afraid of anything 500 watts that costs $20.
Oh, yeah. And
as you should be.
And you've sort of got these Molex connectors that rattle on the ends of their cables, and the cables all sort of just hang out this big hole in the box, and, you know, it's a sheet of tin that's held together by a few screws, and okay, so you get what you pay for. I possibly wouldn't be buying at the low end of the power supply spectrum, because when that power supply does go bang, and there's a pretty high probability that it will, it is probably going to take some of the stuff in the computer with it.
I've got a cheap computer case story for you guys. I built a computer. It was my first computer, and I'm like, okay, it's a case. And it's a big case. And it's a really cheap case. So I pick up this case, and I get it. It's all metal. But honestly, it is the worst designed thing. It's got these little plastic things. It's got a few metal little risers between the motherboard, but mostly little plastic things to keep it up off of the case. And the connectors didn't quite fit, so we had to do a little bit of drilling and chiseling to actually make my motherboard fit. So really, guys, don't cheap out on cases or power supplies. Make sure you get something at least mid-range, or else you do get what you pay for.
We have a saying that until you've bled into your first computer, you don't really own it. We wouldn't suggest you do that, but believe me, some of the cheap cases have edges that are sharper than the cheap knives that you can buy for a similar price. So it always helps to cover the edges in tape if you've got one of those cheap cases, or buy a case that's a little bit more expensive.
There's definitely blood on that computer. Okay, we're going to talk about next, if anybody has any other questions about power supplies, selecting a case.
What is... how do you actually shop for these? Like, if you're at the store, and you find, and you decide, well, I'm going to build myself a computer, how do I shop for the, to make sure I have a good quality case and stuff like that?
You're going to want to, we're going to go over some factors that you might look for in a case, but basically you want to make sure that it isn't, a lot of this is done over the internet, I do a lot of this on the internet, but you want to make sure that the case is, you know, the edges aren't sharp, as Carrie said. You want to make sure it's a nice, big case, especially as a blind person. I mean, unless you have space concerns, because you want to be able to work inside of it, and you want room for expansion. You'll also want to make sure that it's got enough slots and spaces for ports. And you've got to make sure your case is the right form factor, which we'll be talking about here in a second.
I was just going to say, I think the general question was how do you pick the parts in general? And generally you do that by doing online research, you read reviews, you see what other people have said about the components, and if you're in the States, Tiger Direct. If you're in Australia,
computermarket.com.au. In America, pricewatch.com is awesome. It's got all of the Newegg and Tiger Direct and all that prices, and all sorts of other manufacturers who sell computer parts, and it's got it listed by price, so you can find the best quality motherboards or whatever for the cheapest price, and you just compare and look at them, and it's for all sorts of computer parts. I mainly used PriceWatch to buy all of my computer parts for my computer build that I did.
Can you spell that?
PriceWatch, the two words price and watch .com.
It is good. It really is good.
Careful though, don't buy the cheapest. I have a good, fast, cheap, pick two.
Right. But you can kind of go down, and when you start seeing the nicer ones, you can find the nicer ones at the cheapest price because it is listed by price. It's good. I think you can sort it, though, if you want to. And you guys do have an assignment for this chapter, which is to do some online research and shop for computer parts. So, yeah. And if somebody's wanting to build a computer, let me know, and you can do your own research for that and not use the parts that they're suggesting. Okay, so when we select a case, it is dependent on the user's needs. And the user might not always be you. You might be working with a company to pick out computers that they need. So we've got to think about them. So in a little tiny office, we might want a smaller, slimmer profiled computer. In general, you want to select a case that has room for expansion, is durable. Don't pick one that with one kick it's going to fall apart. And easy to work inside. You don't want a tiny little case where you can barely fit your hands into, like Carrie's little mini ITX box. Some customers, as I said, need a smaller case, or they might not want a case that goes on their desks. Consider the size of the motherboard and how many internal or external drive bays you've got. Also, make sure you've got enough slots on your case. The size, this is really important because it's in your test and it's in your final. The size and shape and layout of a case is called a form factor. And the three things that determine a computer's form factor are the case, the motherboard, and the power supply. Very, very, very important.
If you have a player capable of bookmarking, bookmark that section. That is in your test. Bookmark 1, inserted.
Yeah, and it's in your test multiple times. I think there are three different tests that this is in. We had a girl that did that on her Victor stream, actually.
Might not be a bad
idea. Yeah, if you listen to last year's lectures, there's me all the way through going, bookmark 27, inserted.
You can also bookmark with the BookSense, just a side note.
Oh, the BookSense is awesome.
Yeah, any of those, Plex, Dump Pocket, whatever, Daisy Player.
So if you're listening at home, it is really, 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 really important. It asks you on worksheets, it asks you on tests, and some people didn't get this last year, so I'm just making really sure. The three things that determine a computer's form factor are the case, the motherboard, and the power supply. If you get the wrong one of these, the wrong size, your computer's not going to go together. So,
Grace, that was the motherboard, the case and the power supply, was it?
Yeah, it was the motherboard, the case and the power supply.
Okay.
Sorry, guys, people seriously didn't get this last year, and I really want to make sure everybody's got it. It's important.
What's the supply has a ATX or micro ATX or whatnot specification as well?
Yes, it does.
Yep, it does. And those are the form factors.
Yes, it does. You can have micro ATX power supplies, you can have ITX power supplies, you can actually have cases that actually have the power supply external to the case, and they just run the 5 and 12 volt lines into the case. So the case can be specific to the power supply.
Is it safe to touch the outside of an external
there's a
power
really
supply
good...
while it's on?
Oh, yeah. Yes, it is. If you have to touch the back to flip off the switch or to flip on the switch or just to check if there was, if there's air coming out of the fan vents, that's okay to do. You don't want to, you know, stick your hand in the live socket or something, but, you know.
Power supplies can provide 12 volts at 10 amps or 5 volts at 20 amps, and it won't kill you, but boy does it bite. So careful what you're doing with your Molex connectors and stuff. Don't just sort of stick one in your mouth because your hands are full. If the power supply is powered up, you will know about it.
Could that kill you?
No, it just really hurt.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So if it is so important to have, you know, the case, the motherboard, the power supply all matched up, how difficult is that to do as a blind person looking for these things? How would you make sure
it's going
that
to say
matched?
if we're assuming first we're going to decide on the form factor we want. So let's say ATX. And these sites are really good about putting that this is an ATX form factor or whatever in the descriptions. You just want to make sure all three of those descriptions match. So when you're looking for cases and power supplies and stuff, and I will check your work on this and make sure that you've got the right form factor. So if you don't, I'll be helping you with this as you do your worksheet. It says ATX or BTX. You want to make sure all three of those match up, and they're very good at doing this in their descriptions. And if you find a site that isn't good at it, maybe you shouldn't be researching on that particular site.
Or, heaven forbid, this is another option, just mentioning this. In these worksheets, you'll have to research it online. But sometimes if you really don't feel comfortable with this, maybe you should go down to the computer shop and let them help you.
That's going to cost you more, though, usually.
Yes, but there is a peace of mind, and if the computer shop actually matches the components for you, they have a responsibility to ensure that they work together, and you have a warranty. And for some people,
this is true.
That is very important. It's why, for example, we have adaptive technology companies that install all the software and stuff on your mobile phone for you, because there are some users that really shouldn't do it. There are some users, however, that really should. So that is really a personal decision by the user. And you have to understand that if you are going to put your computer together and you manage to damage the parts whilst you're putting the computer together, whilst Kieran and Troy Frisbee CDs around the other side of the room here, you will find that you actually will not get any warranty coverage if you break the components.
There is something that you can get done. I don't know if they do it around here, but in America they will. If you're going to buy, say, a motherboard and power supply and case and even a CPU, you can get these people to preassemble a portion of that for you and pack it up, and they will test the portion that they actually build for you so that you have the peace of mind that those parts work. So then you've got all that done, now you can put your components in. And if I didn't have sighted assistance to build a computer again, I think that's something I might do.
It's usually an assembly fee of 30 to 50 drives. $30 or $40 or whatever. They'll tend to do the system assembly. One of the other things I found, though, is some of the people that do the system assemblies aren't particularly good, and you have to come, when it turns up, you end up sort of straightening case panels out and redoing standoffs and stuff. So you've got to be careful with who does the assembly. Hang on, there's a question in chat.
The actual power supply in the laptop, there's only one power supply. There's a transformer between the adapter and the laptop, but the power supply is actually built into the laptop, and the battery is a source of power, but not really the power supply that converts and makes sure that all the power goes to the right components.
Yeah, actually, it's the power supply converts the power from AC down to DC, and we'll talk about those different things later. And then the batteries are charged by a charge circuit. Then the laptop usually runs off the battery, or if the battery is not present, it runs off the charge circuit. If you're one of the unlucky people who've had a Mac with a battery that blows up, and they expand and you get big bulges in them, you can actually run your Mac purely off its AC adapter.
The power supply in a laptop is more of a power regulator. The battery may be supplying power, but you still need that internal power supply to regulate and manage your power for you. Go ahead.
You can sometimes get away with breaking your hardware. Like, it just sort of depends. Because I was an idiot when I was putting my motherboard together, and I messed up the video. And because it was just in the first week, I sent it back, and I got a replacement. As I said, it was dead on arrival. What can I do? And, you know, they replaced it. But on the other hand,
you were really lucky.
Yeah. Most technicians over here are very careful to actually see what sort of damage is done. And then they actually look at it and see whether it could have been done by a user, or they tend to look at it and see whether it could have been done by an error in transport, which is why, and this is not something that you should do, and if we catch any of you doing it, there'll be trouble. You have to kill bits of hardware in constructive ways with piezo gas lighters and stuff with undetectable damage from overvoltage. So that you can get replacement parts. Not that any computer shops ever do that when they're returning things to the supplier. No, never.
Never, never.
No way. And on the other hand, for processors and stuff, they specifically say if you bend a pin, they're not going to replace it. Which
right.
is very easy to do and very annoying. It's easy to fix too, but not if you're blind.
In fact, the pin grid array where you actually bend the pins in the socket will actually invalidate your motherboard rather than your processor, and that can be a bit of a pain as well. And but then you get side of people who are very carefully trying to bend pins back into line, and if you succeed in bending them back into line, well and good. If you snap one off, game over, Red Rover.
You curl into a corner and cry.
Pretty much, especially if you bought a really nice motherboard.
Yeah. What does a laptop's internal power regulator, power supply, however you described it, what does that actually look like? Is it like a little board, or what
does
that
actually look
like? Yeah, it's a
circuit board. That's a good question. I've never actually got my hands on one.
Yeah, it looks like a little circuit board. It's got basically voltage regulators and stuff that control getting the various voltages to the right parts of the laptop, i.e. the 5 and the 12 and that sort of thing.
And is the jack for the AC adapter part of that, or is that a separate piece in and of itself that connects to this thing?
No, the power supply is inside the laptop. The actual board inside the laptop is the one that actually does the regulation and stuff. The power supply that usually comes and feeds power into the laptop usually converts from 110 or 240 volts down to 19 or 18 or 16 or 14 or 12 volts. We might cover the form factors to a degree, and we'll see how much of the form factors we cover. However, it is all in your notes! Exclamation
And they've got this. Actually, I was going to purposely not cover the specific form factors because they have this amazing diagram description in there, and it's very, very, very good. And it's going to do a better job than I could ever do with describing these form factors to you and why and how that all works. So I was going to purposely refer you guys back to your notes because this diagram is really good, and it's going to help you out and explain it to you quite a bit better than I will.
I just want to make... There are no text notes for Discovery 1. No text notes for Discovery 1. Okay? Just making this very clear. I do not want to see anything on the mailing list that says, are there text notes for Discovery 1? There are not. Thank you. End of public service announcement.
They're accessible flash. And they're really good.
Is it possible, if you want a sighted person to check and just describe to you, I'm sure the diagram descriptions are good, but if you want to have someone, can you go through very carefully the Flash curriculum and get to that point and it will show the picture? I mean, is that something?
Absolutely. In fact, okay. You can go through the Flash curriculum anytime you want to. And it's readable, and it's doable to, I mean, I did it. I've done it before. It's not nice, but it's very doable. So yeah, it's not a. You don't even have to be very careful about it. You can get it. You can get it to run.
So I'm thinking about having a pair of eyes look on some of this stuff for me.
Well, if there are things that you'd like added to the diagram descriptions, we're certainly up for modifying the diagram descriptions and stuff. So if something's unclear from the diagram descriptions, but it all depends on how you find the diagram descriptions. We'd like to think they're very good, but then again, we're biased.
Well, do it. Well, more power to you if you do that. I think they're great, because in most classes you don't get that kind of diagram descriptions, and you aren't that lucky. So, yeah, I think they're awesome compared to some of the stuff I've actually done as a college student. That's awful.
Yeah, pretty much. And then you can blame the part-time kid for breaking it.
No, the part-time kid will replace it.
Well, either way.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Hope he doesn't lose his job. That would suck. I'd feel bad.
That'd we don't really do that. We're supposed to be... down the line. In ITE1, we're supposed to be ethical people? Really?
That wasn't my idea, let the record show.
Okay, let's continue on.
Yeah, yeah.
Is it possible, because I know that some cases have power...
He isn't transmitting anymore.
Drew, you cut out.
Yeah. I know, sorry about that.
You're back. You're back. Maybe. Ooh. No, you're not.
No, you've got some really special things going on with your microphone there. Alright, well, when you get that figured out, let us know.
We can come back to his question.
Yep, absolutely. Alright, now where were we? we were going to talk about factors for choosing the cases.
Here we go. Yes, some power supplies mount the power supply. Yes, you can, although generally speaking they match the form factor, and if the form factor is correct you can mount the power supply on the top or on the bottom. Sometimes the cases put the power supply on the bottom for better cooling and heat dissipation. It just depends on how the cases are designed. And in answer to your question, it's possible to screw anything up if you try hard enough. I've seen people put round pegs in square holes. I've seen people put ISA cards into PCI slots. I've seen people put PCI cards in upside down. If it doesn't go, we'll just force it. Where's my hammer? So exercise a bit of care, people, and a little bit of common sense, and you won't have a lot of these things happen to you. Yeah, can we just move on so we don't see Module 1, Part 3? Okay, cool.
Yeah, that'd probably be good.
I read a story about someone forcing RAM into a PCMCIA slot.
Yep, it's happened.
Wow. Yep. RAM can be quite tricky. And we'll be talking about RAM probably next week. Okay, so... we've got form factors. Can anyone tell me the difference between a desktop and a tower PC?
The desktops are sort of flat, square... things that a monitor can sit on top of, and then the tower is the big tall thing that sits on the floor. And well, it could sit on your desk too, but generally they go on the people put them on the floor and they're tall and big.
Yep. A desktop usually sits on a desk. It's usually kind of a square flat box, and I honestly thought that they were kind of going out. Yeah, I kind of thought that they were going out of style, and yeah, they are coming back.
It's weird.
It is very strange.
Ah, but do you know why?
No.
Because all the monitors and stuff got lighter, so now it's possible to just sit an LCD on the monitor.
sorry, an LCD monitor on top of the desktop because they're not as heavy as the CRTs, and it makes the whole footprint of the computer a lot smaller if you've got an LCD sitting on top and the desktop sitting on your desk.
I hadn't even thought of that.
Me neither. Well, I don't usually use a monitor, so that's probably why.
I think you can also tilt those monitors so you have a very... You can sort of customize your viewing angle.
You can. Okay, so we've got the desktops and the towers, so don't be confused, because a lot of people call any PC a desktop PC, or any kind of, not a laptop, any kind of not as movable PC a desktop, which is okay to do.
Just a point, yeah. Some people might want to know, I don't know whether anybody's noticed, but when you plug, and a lot of the keyboards are USB, so this isn't an issue, but when you plug in DIN plugs, such as a PS2 keyboard and mouse, has anybody ever noticed how on a tower case, the little arrow that marks the top of the connector actually has to point to the side, usually to the right? That's because if you plug those in on a desktop, usually the arrow should point to the top, so on a tower they are 90 degrees shifted across.
Okay, yeah, because the keyboard I use, the part of the plug is actually and flat, so you can tell. I know what you're saying.
That's right. So the flat side goes to the side.
Since we're talking about
any advantage or disadvantage to desktaps and towers depends on your mount.
Yeah, it's a PS2 over USB for keyboards.
Yes, there is.
Well, there are advantages and disadvantages. The PS2, it's a dedicated keyboard port, so you're not using up a USB. But they're not hot swappable, and you can actually damage your computer by unplugging or plugging in a PS2 while your computer's on.
However, PS2 keyboards and mice will work when the USB stack is not loaded or when you forgot to enable USB keyboard support in the BIOS. So it can be handy to have a PS2 keyboard to get yourself into the BIOS and enable USB keyboard support so that you can then use your USB keyboard in the BIOS. Also, if your driver predates Windows, your operating system predates Windows, or you don't have USB drivers loaded, your keyboards won't function.
So there are advantages and disadvantages to both. It's really up to you which you like to use. I personally prefer USB. So we're going to talk about factors when choosing a case. There are more when you actually want to choose a case. Some of them are model type. Do you want a desktop or tower? What kind of space is it going to take up? You also, of course, want the form factor. What type of motherboard and shape of motherboard and power supply is going to be in this case? Of course, the size and shape must match exactly. We talked about the size and available space already. Some people want a really fancy, glitzy display-type case with little windows and LEDs so they can see all sorts of different things happening in their computers. Mainly it's gamers that really want that. And vents.
Yeah, Alienware.
They're Dell now.
Vents. Vents are very important. You want to make sure that your case has proper ventilation and places for you to install fans so that the heat can dissipate and you don't get a really, really hot case. I've had a case. I didn't build this computer. It was one of those really nice small cases, and I actually overheated the motherboard because there wasn't enough ventilation and cooling in that case.
Won't the system usually just lock up if you're in danger of breaking something?
Maybe.
One would hope, but
not necessarily.
This one
or just turn off.
No, not all systems have heat sensors and overheat protection and stuff. It depends how cheap your system board was.
This one didn't, and you touched it, and it was red hot. It was crazy. So we told them it was something that was bought for me by vocational rehabilitation, so it had a care plan on it, and we let them know that that was
quite defective. So your last word dropped off there.
Oh, sorry about that. We're going to talk a little bit about power supplies quickly before we wrap up today. As I said, make sure that your power supply can hold more, can give out more power than you actually need, in case you ever want to upgrade and put more components into your system. Because if you don't, you'll be upgrading the power supply again, too. You just don't need that cost. So do it once, save yourself some money. Motherboards have different types of connectors on them. And today, most of the connectors that you're going to see are keyed to only go in one way. This is not always true. I assumed this once in a class I was in, and I'm doing my computer assembly and disassembly lab. And I put this all together, and I'm like, somebody, you know, I turn it on, and it won't turn on. And so I get someone over to check my work. Well, firstly, the power supply thing was not pushed directly in, which was a very good thing, because the hard drive connector was not keyed, and it was in the wrong way, and we could have had some very nice fireworks with the power connector being plugged in the wrong way, if somebody had not come and checked for me. So most of the time they are, but on very old computers or very cheap parts, that may not be the case. Beware.
Also, the older computers, the AT stuff, which you'll still come across from time to time, very rare, but you still see it, P8 and P9, they are exactly, you can put them in either order, so you basically make sure the black one's in the middle, as we say, red to red, black to black, turn the switch and stand back.
And hope and pray with the computer that old. I'm just going to go over the list of power connector types, and then I think we'll wrap up and we'll start with Ohm's law next week.
Just a point. Power connectors are in your test. Power connectors are in your test. Power connectors are in your test. You need to know what the Molex, the Berg, and the other one is for. So these are in your test, in your test, in your test. Okay? Can't make it much more obvious than that.
Bookmark two. Okay. A Molex connector is a keyed connector, and Molex is used to connect optical or hard drives. Molex is optical or hard drives. A Berg connector is a keyed connector used to connect a floppy drive. It's smaller than a Molex connector, so you'll be able to feel the difference between them. And you may not see very many Berg connectors anymore because they are kind of going out of style with the old floppy drives. Alright, for the actual power supply connector itself, it's a big rectangular 20 or 24 pin slotted connector, and it's used to connect the motherboard to the actual power supply. It has two rows of 12 pins each. Well, obviously the 20 pin one has two rows of 10 pins each. If you have a 20-pin and you need extra power, you can get the 4 to 8-pin extra power cord, and it plugs in right next to the 20-pin connector, and will usually only go in one way, which is good.
What's that 20-pin connector called?
The ATX power connector.
Okay, thanks.
And because the because there are actually power good signals on an ATX 24-pin power connector, your machine will not power up until you plug that in, obviously. There used to be cases in the old computers where the switches were dual-pole single-throw, where you could actually turn the power supply on without it actually being connected into the system board, but that's no longer possible. The power supply won't fire up.
The system has, I think it's 20-pin, and then like right below it, is the extra 4-pin. It's a different socket, but it's like right below it, and then my power supply has the extra 4-pin connector that like is impossible for it to move like more than 3 inches in any direction, so I'm kind of confused why they don't just make that one socket.
They can, but obviously some motherboards are only got 20-pin connectors on the boards, and also the AMD system boards used to not use the 24-pin connector. They used to use a 20-pin connector and then a different connector up near the CPU.
Mine did that as well. I had that going on with my power connector, and we had to, I think we had to get order in a special part or something for it. Something about that. I don't know, it was a while ago. So...
Yeah, it confused me because with the physical layout, it had the 20-pin connector, and then, like, the socket for the other four pins was, like, right below it. Like literally, like, less than a centimeter below. It was, like, in the exact same spot.
Okay. Yep, that makes sense. It talks about the P8 and P9 connectors, which Carrie has already gone through. They're not keyed, and they could be installed backwards, and that will really damage your motherboard and your power supply. So... if you're having a sighted person help you with this, black to black. Remember that the ones go in the center. And I think that's where we're going to stop. Does anyone have any questions or feedback on the lecture?
What's the name of the power connector for fans?
Fan power. There's 2-pin and 3-pin fan power connectors. That's what they're called.
Go ahead.
What I'm wondering is, like on my Dell here, it has a series, it's actually a sort of a cascaded cable with an edge connector for it to connect to the SATA drives, the internal SATA drives, and maybe another one. I think that's a four wire cable, but they're not Molex plugs.
No, they're SATA power plugs. That's Mike.
Yes, it is.
That's okay. So we don't all know everybody's voices yet. So for the first couple of lectures, and we know who you are now, but if people can just say their name briefly, although usually if we acknowledge you, we'll say your name just for the first lecture or two, because there's no easy way for people to tell who's talking on Ventrilo.
Is there, because my motherboard has SATA power plugs all over the place too. Is there any particular advantage or disadvantage to SATA plugs over Molex?
Yes.
Yeah, it depends what drive you're using. You don't get a choice.
You do, actually.
Something that has a Molex drive.
There are actually drives that have both of the power connectors on them. They have the SATA power and they have the Molex, and you only provide power to one set of connectors, either the SATA or the Molex, but some of the newer SATA drives only have the SATA power connectors. And I believe the SATA power connectors are an 8-wire connector, and for future expansion they actually have a 3.3-volt rail built into that power, so they've got 5, 12 and 3.3 volts. But most of the modern SATA drives only use the 5 and 12 volt rails at this stage.
This is Sean again. So the Molex connectors are for the EIDE drives, the old ones, and then the SATA ones are for newer drives? Is that how that
works?
That's
right.
That's right. SATA ones are for SATA. Go ahead.
Because I have an older system, so would that be Molex connectors on the power supply then for the drive?
Yeah.
If it doesn't have SATA in it? Okay.
The are thin and wide, so they're about an inch wide, whereas the Molex are slightly fatter. They're about a quarter inch thick, and they're about 3/4 inch wide or so. Some of the older drives, as I said, have both SATA and legacy connectors, which is very handy because I've got a computer where I ran out of SATA power connectors, and I had some legacy Molexes left, and I was able to power four of the RAID drives with the legacy connectors.
Yeah, I had an older SATA drive that had Molex on it. SATA power feels a great... connectors and plugs feel similar to SATA-enabled data cable longer, but they feel sort of like that. You can also get Molex to SATA connector adapter things as well.
Okay, I think... I need to see people drop like flies. So any questions, use the mailing list. Otherwise, if there is enough interest, we can fire up on Ventrilo tomorrow morning and cover a bit more if there's something people want to talk about. And thank you all for attending.
Hey, Grace, had something about the class, the notes, the ITE text notes that I noticed. I'm noticing that... when a list comes up, like a list of things, and you know where it says list of 8 items or whatever, each of those items is preceded by an I. Actually, the Mac is calling it I with diuresis, and
It's supposed to be a bullet.
I actually went and replaced those. Was that something I should have done? I mean, myself?
You can do whatever you want to your own local copy. I don't know that we're going to be updating or doing anything with these with these notes, because we are moving to another curriculum soonish.
I just know that and apostrophes are doing funny things, too. Apostrophes are showing up as an I acute. And both of those things just drove me absolutely insane. Because I'm just like, why is it saying I before everything?
That's because there's a difference in the character mappings and stuff, and a lot of the documents were saved out into text files from Word that doesn't use regular apostrophes. And then it goes into the Mac, and then the Mac mangulates it another way with whatever it's using or shows the characters up. So if you read them in Word, you probably won't find those sorts of problems.
Or Notepad, or WordPad.
Oh, okay. All right.
Because it'll look real nice in those. That's what it's formatted for. Oh.
Oh, okay. I don't know if anyone even uses a bookport anymore, but I do. I love mine. Anyway.
I loved my bookport.
I would use it.
I will never, ever get rid of this thing. Because you can't make
them
anymore.
No, those are pretty awesome.
The Bookport Plus is coming, and I'm kind of sad because it's not going to be the same. But, yeah, it didn't like them either.
Okay, fair enough.
I'll do a Notepad next time.
Well, I'll see how you go. I mean, you could probably clean them up. We'd probably write a said script that would tidy them up if we could be bothered. I'm just going to hit stop on the recording.